While the Pentagon Papers didn't deal with atrocities per se, the study contained candid analyses and secret documents outlining official lies that had kept the American public in the dark about the war through four presidential administrations. Chief among the revelations was the fact that, despite high-minded public rhetoric, U.S. war managers had little, if any, concern for the Vietnamese people, regarding South Vietnam as nothing more than a strategic site in the Cold War power struggle. Sheehan's first articles about the secret study ran in the New York Times in June 1971, and the airing of decades' worth of deceptions, along with the government's strenuous efforts to prevent newspapers from publishing more of the material, added to the growing public perception that the Pentagon could not be trusted. More and more, the tide of public opinion was turning against the ongoing conflict. Just a week after the Pentagon Papers began to be made public, the International Commission of Inquiry into United States Crimes in Indochina brought together scholars, journalists, and other experts on the war in Oslo, Norway. Several American veterans testified, including a bomber pilot, an artillery forward observer, an infantryman, and an interrogator. They were joined in an almost unprecedented move by Vietnamese survivors, who offered eyewitness accounts of the war from the civilian side. The commission's conclusion was stark and damning. The numerous witnesses, it said, together have given a remarkably consistent overall picture of the U.S. warfare in Indochina. We have listened to U.S. soldiers, formerly attached to different branches of the military in Indochina, revealing what they did to the local population, acts often influenced by racial bias acquired during the course of their upbringing and military training. We have listened to statements from victims, from men and women and children, about what they have experienced of torture, imprisonment, attacks from the air, or deportation. Whole villages and vast areas of their country have been destroyed. In addition to all this, we have received information from medical doctors, scientists, and journalists concerning what they have seen. It all adds up to the same picture. The Commission is convinced that the crimes committed in Indochina are not only the results of actions of individual soldiers and officers. Clearly, these crimes are the results of the long-term policy of the United States in Southeast Asia, and the main burden of responsibility must lie with those who have been making this policy. Top Washington officials, however, were not about to go down without a fight. With long experience at covering up war crimes, they knew just how to evade the burden of responsibility that the Oslo Commission so unambiguously placed on them. Drag out all the investigations as long as possible, intimidate witnesses, obstruct courts-martial, and hope that the public would eventually lose interest. Throughout the early 1970s, this would be the military's steadfast approach. My Lai was a perfect case study. Aside from Lieutenant Kelly, the initial CID investigation of the massacre had involved 44 former members of Charlie Company as well as two other officers. Of them, the Army decided to charge 30 with major crimes, but later quietly dropped the charges against 17 former servicemen, leaving only the 13 men who were still on active duty. By April 1971, the Pentagon was saying that an exhaustive study had determined that discharged soldiers could not be tried. This was a lie. Behind the scenes, in a written opinion from December 1969, the Army's General Counsel Robert Jordan had made it clear that military commissions or tribunals could be used to try ex-soldiers. The only difficulty was that such military commissions would have required an order from the White House. "We would have needed the President's support to proceed," Jordan explained years later, "and the President of the United States didn't support prosecution of Vietnam War crimes." Not that such prosecutions would necessarily have made much difference. In late 1970, when proceedings began against the active duty men, case after case had quickly evaporated, as powerful generals dismissed charges and military juries let perpetrators off the hook. Sergeant Charles Hutto, one of the first men to be tried, was acquitted at his court-martial even though he himself had described the events at My Lai as murder to an Army investigator, adding, "I wasn't happy about shooting all the people anyway. I didn't agree with all the killing, but we were doing it because we'd been told." Eventually, Kelly would be the only person convicted in connection with the massacre, as if the deaths of more than 500 civilians, carried out by dozens of men at the behest of higher command, were his fault alone. The story was much the same when it came to the cover-up of the My Lai massacre. The Peers panel had named 28 officers, including two generals, as being involved in the cover-up. Four of them were already deceased by the time of the report. The colonel tapped by Westmoreland to draft charges, however, chose to pursue legal action against just 11 of the officers that the Peers panel had named. When members of the panel tried to charge 4 additional officers, Secretary of the Army Resor personally stepped in to shield one of those men. A total of just 14 officers thus ultimately had to face charges relating to the cover-up. 12 of them saw their cases dismissed before trial. The other 2, including Colonel Henderson, were acquitted. Meanwhile, the Mi-Kai massacre that the Peers panel had also detailed in its report was effectively buried by the military. All the evidence amassed about it was classified as top secret and hidden away in Pentagon files, and the case was left to die in conspiratorial silence. And with the combined efforts of CID and the War Crimes Working Group, the military set about burying other cases as well. Army agents intimidated potential witnesses and whistleblowers, plied them with alcohol during interviews, entreated them to lie, and carried out overt surveillance meant to bully them into silence. Some government agents showed up at workplaces to demonstrate their power to jeopardize jobs. Others attempted to bully friends and relatives, or tried to get them to undermine a veteran's credibility. As official investigations of war crimes cases dragged out for years, passing from one agent to another, sent up the chain of command, and kicked back down for reinvestigation, they were often strung out until most suspects were considered beyond the reach of military justice. Stephen Chukala, legal advisor to CID Chief Henry Tufts, later tried to excuse the routine mismanagement of war crimes allegations, saying that the CID was overworked and understaffed. He also admitted that the entire Army investigative and judicial system was aligned against the process. Agents were blasé about investigations, while generals running stateside bases were reluctant to press charges. Even when court-martial proceedings did get launched, prosecutors had little inclination to perform their best, and military juries were unlikely to convict. Everybody wanted Vietnam to go away, Chukala recalled. In the spring of 1971, Secretary of Defense Melvin Laird ordered the Army's Criminal Investigation Division to be brought under tighter Pentagon control. In theory, this measure was supposed to lead to greater accountability and oversight. In practice, it allowed key Defense Department officials to take an even more active role in suppressing war crimes cases. Investigations could now be quashed at the highest levels, and evidence suggests that, indeed, they were. One Tiger Force officer, for example, recalled that during the Army's investigation of his unit's war crimes, he was personally summoned to the Pentagon to attend a meeting with a major general at his side. According to the officer, an official showed them a legal brief that said the case had been closed. That brief, the officer explained, essentially said, "Yep, there's wrongdoing here and we know about it, but basically it's not in the best interest of this, that, and the other to try to pursue this." What Tiger Force troopers had done in Quang Ngai and Quang Tin, the officer said years later, was kept awful quiet. This was a hot potato. See, this was after the My Lai scandal, and the Army certainly didn't want to go through the publicity thing again. Or take the case of Robert Miller, a soldier from Jamie Henry's unit who provided a sworn eyewitness statement to Army criminal investigators corroborating Henry's allegations about the massacre in Quang Nam. As the investigation proceeded, Miller was visited by a colonel who claimed to know their former company commander from the Pentagon. "The colonel was there to find out if I was going to go public," Miller later recalled. When the colonel got belligerent and insulted him, Miller threw him out of his home. Still, the visit had its effect. When CID agents returned, Miller clammed up and refused to tell them anything more. High-level intervention was even more striking when it came to the investigation of atrocities reported by Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Herbert. The allegations included Herbert's descriptions of torture at the 172nd Military Intelligence Detachment compound, as well as other horrific stories, such as his account of an incident in which South Vietnamese forces looted and burned a village, beat civilians, and murdered several detainees, all in the presence of a U.S. military advisor. In late 1970, General Westmoreland sent out a memo directing that a special team be put together to deal with Herbert's charges. "I will be kept informed of progress made," he decreed. As a result, CID created a Herbert Task Force, headed by Major Carl Hensley, to conduct an unusually comprehensive investigation. The Army's inquiry quickly bore out Herbert's atrocity claims. At that point, Hensley's wife, Dolores, recalled, "Carl withdrew into a shell, stopped eating, did not talk to the children, and did not or would not talk to me. Soon after, he went to a doctor for his nerves and began taking medication and seeing a military psychiatrist. He talked in abstract terms about problems on the job, the psychiatrist, Major William Leggett subsequently said in a sworn statement. Hensley couldn't discuss his job, Leggett told me years later. My impression was that it was because there was something big he was keeping secret. In his memoir, Herbert recalled that Hensley phoned him in early April 1971 to say the crimes had occurred the way Herbert said they had. The major promised to talk to CID Chief Henry Tufts and get some results. At home, however, Hensley became ever more despondent. He kept saying that he had suppressed information and could get 4 to 10 years at Leavenworth for what he knew, his wife later told Army investigators. I asked what did he know, and he kept saying, enough, enough, it goes all the way up to the highest. Then, she added, he went into a deeper state of depression and kept saying the only way out was to shoot himself. On April 15th, after their children had left for school, Hensley asked his wife to take their baby downstairs so he could take a nap. She did, but then slipped off her shoes and crept back up the stairs, where she found him standing in the bedroom with a shotgun. I screamed, Carl, give me the goddamn gun. He pulled the trigger. Hensley's daughter, Carla, who was 13 at the time, came home from school to see a swarm of Army agents at her house, rummaging through her father's belongings and confiscating papers. They pulled the trash cans. They left nothing behind, she recalled years later. A neighbor of the Hensleys had a similar recollection. The military came in and swept the house clean. Every piece of paper they turned over. They went through the trash. They went through their books. They searched through everything. The very next day, despite the fact that Hensley left no known suicide note, no interviews had been conducted with his family, and no investigation of the death had been carried out. A Pentagon spokesman announced that CID Chief Henry Tufts had already fully explored the circumstances of Hensley's death and could find absolutely no connection between it and the Herbert investigation. In late 1971, the assistant to the Army's General Counsel would write privately to CID legal advisor Chukala, informing him that such assertions had been inaccurate and that there was indeed evidence to substantiate a connection. When CID did finally conduct an inquiry into Hensley's death, they made sure to interview Dr. Leggett. As he later recalled, they were concerned about some war crimes incidents in Vietnam, but the Army's files mentioned nothing on the subject, and the entire investigation of the suicide seemingly ignored the question of what information Hensley might have suppressed. In the end, the Army admitted nothing. Herbert would retire from the military in 1972, but criminal investigators would continue to work his case, mainly by going through his memoir and looking for ways to attack him. By 1973, they had compiled a 53-page catalog of alleged discrepancies in Herbert's public accounts of his time in the military. This package provides sufficient material to impeach this man's credibility. Should this need arise, I volunteer for the task. Tufts wrote in a letter to Creighton Abrams, who had by then succeeded Westmoreland as Army Chief of Staff. The scores of atrocities that the Army uncovered as a result of Herbert's charges would remain secret for decades. With the My Lai trials fizzling out, and the Army efficiently bottling up hundreds of other atrocity allegations, including the Tiger Force killings, the issue of war crimes gradually began to fade from public consciousness. The memorable testimonies offered by veterans at the Winter Soldier investigation were ultimately just personal stories. Without some official confirmation from formal investigations and military trials, it was all too easy for skeptics to dismiss them as politically motivated exaggerations, mere anti-war agitprop. At the same time, Nixon was steadily rebranding the conflict. A policy of Vietnamization, handing the ground war over to South Vietnamese forces and drawing down U.S. troops, had begun in the waning days of the Johnson administration, and by mid-1971 it increasingly pushed the war off the newspaper front pages. Fewer American combat troops and fewer American deaths, plus a war fatigue that struck newsrooms and living rooms alike, increasingly reduced the ongoing conflict to a secondary issue. Once we've broken the war in Vietnam, Henry Kissinger, Nixon's national security advisor, told the president, no one will give a damn about war crimes. What's more, the exposure of My Lai paradoxically worked against bringing other war crimes to public attention. Atypically large as far as massacres by ground troops were concerned, My Lai dwarfed other mass killings, making many of the atrocity allegations that surfaced later seem small and less newsworthy by comparison. It was almost as if America's leading media outlets had gone straight from ignoring atrocities to treating them as old news, with just a brief flurry of interest in between. Only something bigger than My Lai, in scale and scope, might then have galvanized national attention. Westmoreland knew of at least one such potentially game-changing revelation, Operation Speedy Express, which had unleashed nonstop death for half a year across thousands of square miles densely crowded with civilians. But with the Army having quickly killed any investigation into the concerned sergeant's letters, and with the anonymous letter writer himself falling silent after his first few messages, it appeared that the details of this operation would, like so many other atrocities, forever remain a secret from the general public. Unlike the hundreds of atrocity reports and allegations that were neatly buried in Westmoreland's office by the War Crimes Working Group, however, Speedy Express did not simply disappear. Back in February 1968, the same month that Julian Ewell had taken command of the 9th Infantry Division in the Mekong Delta, another American had arrived in Vietnam for his first tour, Newsweek reporter Kevin Buckley, a Yale graduate who quickly became a press corps mainstay. By 1971, Buckley was serving as Newsweek's Saigon bureau chief, and his hires included a young Vietnamese-speaking former aid worker named Alexander Shimkin. And Shimkin, it turned out, was more than a little obsessive. The son of a retired military intelligence officer turned college professor, Shimkin had spent his spare time when he was growing up filling notebook after notebook with the order of battle for the armies of World War I, unit identifications, command structure, troop strength, and so on. Years later, he had his family send those notebooks to him in Vietnam to keep himself busy at night. He liked to amass knowledge, to absorb it, to roll it around in his mind and figure out what it all meant. So it was hardly surprising that when Shimkin arrived at Newsweek, he made a beeline for the archive of yellowing papers that the U.S. military had long been handing out to reporters. The only surprising thing was that the magazine had bothered to hold on to these souvenirs from the 5 o'clock Follies, the military's much-disparaged nightly press briefing, which had America on the verge of victory every day for years. The hard copy documents accompanying these briefings, though, were in fact often packed with potentially useful data. But most reporters didn't bother to crunch the numbers, perhaps because at this late date in the war, they considered any official military pronouncements to be little more than the stuff of late show punchlines. Shimkin, however, took to the papers as if they contained the secrets of the Somme and Verdun. He digested the accounts and typed up copious notes. Somewhere along the line, something clicked. All those lopsided battles in which sampans were sent to the bottom of the Mekong's murky depths without a single injury to an American, all those enemy forces wiped out with only a weapon or two to show for it, the accumulated stories felt somehow wrong. And when Shimkin looked at the overall numbers, he knew they were wrong. Something dark had taken place in the Delta. A mega My Lai, a massacre that had gone on not for an afternoon, but for a full 6 months. Neither Shimkin nor Buckley knew about the concerned sergeant's letters, but when Shimkin took his preliminary findings to his bureau chief, Buckley knew that they had something big. Almost 4 years covering Vietnam had opened Buckley's eyes to the war's brutal reality. He had seen the Americans respond to the May 1968 mini-Tet by utterly destroying District 8, Saigon's gleaming model of urban renewal. He had taken note of cheerleading killboards toting up the dead at base camps and bloodthirsty slogans emblazoned on helicopters. When Shimkin brought him the results of his document dig, Buckley immediately sensed that the story was worth pursuing in a major way. In the course of their investigation, Buckley and Shimkin found that the 9th Infantry Division had reported killing 10,899 enemy troops during Speedy Express, even though it recovered only 748 weapons. By comparison, South Vietnamese forces fighting alongside the 9th Division, long disparaged for their lack of combat prowess, had captured more than 10 times as many weapons. For some weeks in March and April 1969, the 9th Division's kills-to-weapons ratios were simply ridiculous. During the week of April 19th, for instance, 699 guerrillas had been added to the division's body count at the cost of a single American life, but only 9 weapons were captured. Over the second half of 1971, the two reporters mined almost every source available to them to learn more about the operation. They spoke to American military officers, 9th Infantry Division veterans, and American advisors who had worked in the Delta. They traveled, on foot, by jeep, in boats, and even by raft, into the areas hit hardest by Speedy Express to interview South Vietnamese officials and the villagers filtering back to their ruined hamlets. They surveyed vast areas of destruction, gunfire-pocked buildings, houseless bunkers, cratered rice fields, endless groves of decapitated coconut trees. All the evidence pointed to utterly unrestrained violence on a grand scale. Analyzing medical records in the Ben Tre Provincial Hospital in Qianhua, which served one tiny area of the Delta, Buckley and Shimkin found that during Speedy Express, it had treated 1,430 civilians who had been wounded by U.S. firepower, adding up to more than 200 civilian casualties for every month of the operation around Ben Tre alone. And this calculation was certainly an undercount of the true toll. Many of the people who were wounded in Qianhua never got to any hospital because they died on the way, one U.S. official told Buckley. Many others were treated at home or in hospitals run by the VC or in small dispensaries operated by the South Vietnamese Army. The people who got to Ben Tre were lucky and lived nearby. Overall, an American official with long experience in the Delta told Buckley that as many as 5,000 of the people killed by Speedy Express were non-combatants. The detailed investigation conducted by Buckley and Shimkin themselves arrived at estimates of the same magnitude. In late November 1971, Buckley sent a letter to MACV, drawing their attention to the lopsided kills-to-weapons ratio. Research in the area by Newsweek indicates that a considerable proportion of those people killed during Speedy Express were non-combatant civilians, Buckley wrote. The colonel who headed the MACV information branch soon replied, confirming the ratio and many of the details that the Newsweek reporters were uncovering, such as the high percentage of casualties inflicted at night and by helicopters. He insisted, however, that Buckley's claim about civilian casualties could not be substantiated. Instead, the military contended that many of the dead were simply unarmed guerrillas. What's more, Buckley's request to interview MACV Commander Creighton Abrams was rejected. The MACV spokesman stated that Abrams, who in fact had been briefed on the concerned sergeant's allegations by the Secretary of the Army the year before, had no additional information on the operation. Another prominent official trying to steer clear of Buckley's way at this time was John Paul Vann, who had witnessed the fallout of Speedy Express firsthand. According to David Farnham, Vann's deputy, Vann told him that he was ducking Buckley's questions about the operation because the subject was so sensitive. Unwittingly echoing the concerned sergeant's letter, Vann said that Speedy Express had been, in effect, many me lies. Vann had good reason to keep quiet. Though at one point an outspoken critic of U.S. military strategy, he had always been committed to winning the war, and by 1971 he had talked top officials into believing that he was the man to accomplish the task. Now the third highest-ranking American serving in Vietnam and the first civilian in U.S. history to be placed in command of U.S. military forces in wartime, he wasn't about to let the American effort be destroyed by scandal. While in Washington for the Christmas holiday, he and Farnham met with Westmoreland and Army Vice Chief of Staff Bruce Palmer, Jr. to discuss the implications of Buckley's forthcoming story. At the meeting, Vann told Westmoreland and Palmer that Ewell's 9th Division had wantonly killed civilians to boost its body count and further the general's career, and singled out nighttime helicopter gunship missions as the worst of the division's tactics. According to Farnham, Westmoreland put on a masterful job of acting, claiming repeatedly that he had never before heard such allegations. When Vann mentioned the upcoming Newsweek exposé, Westmoreland directed his aide and Farnham to leave the room. He said that he, Palmer, and Vann needed to discuss a very sensitive subject, and he didn't want the aides to hear the discussion lest they be compelled to testify about it at a later date. Buckley knew that he had the military running scared. He told his editors in New York that, according to a military insider, both MACV and the Pentagon are extremely worried about our research into Speedy. Another official told Buckley that the military had long waited for this particular shoe to drop. As he put it, MACV was afraid they had a PR disaster on their hands with that division and were surprised when it didn't happen. Now, several years after Ewell's reign of terror had ended, the PR disaster was finally upon them. Buckley and Shimkin filed a nearly 5,000-word exposé on the horrors of the operation, plus a powerful sidebar filled with eyewitness testimony from Vietnamese survivors. The results were damning. The piece exposed wanton killing on a massive scale and appeared to conclusively answer the questions the reporters asked in the story's lead. Was the My Lai massacre an isolated incident? Or were civilian casualties a constant, accepted, and indeed inevitable result when American combat units with enormous firepower fought in populated areas. Was My Lai only a particularly gruesome application of a policy which in fact killed many more civilians than were killed in that small village? It was the stuff of Pulitzer Prizes and congressional hearings. For Newsweek, it was a potential blockbuster. For the military, a surefire nightmare. On January 17th, Buckley cabled the first draft to New York. But instead of rushing the story into print, Newsweek's editors pushed back. They claimed that articles about civilians killed by indiscriminate fire were nothing new, objected to Buckley's linking of My Lai and Speedy Express, and requested that the article be radically shortened. They wanted Buckley to focus on a single war crime, not the overarching American way of war. In private cables to New York, Buckley responded by pointing out that the magazine's editors were urging him to cut exactly what terrified the military. They do not fear revelation of more specific atrocities as much as they fear a report which will focus on the inevitability of casualties as a result of command policy. A My Lai-style expose would simply be laid at the feet of some lieutenant or captain, Buckley explained, whereas the story that he and Chimkin wrote points the finger at the top echelon instead of the bottom. Indeed, it is not charges of indiscriminate use of firepower which they fear. Instead, it is charges of quite discriminating use as a matter of policy in populated areas. It is to say that day in and day out, that division killed non-combatants with firepower that was anything but indiscriminate. The application of firepower was based on the judgment that anybody who ran was an enemy, and indeed that anyone who lived in the area could be killed. Still, Chimkin headed back to the Delta for further reporting, where he turned up yet more corroborating Vietnamese witnesses, and Buckley then reworked the article, striving to get it into print before his scheduled departure from Indochina in early 1972. At the opening of the new draft, Buckley wrote, 4 years here have convinced me that terrible crimes have been committed in Vietnam. Specifically, thousands upon thousands of unarmed, non-combatant civilians have been killed by American firepower. They were not killed by accident. The American way of fighting this war made their deaths inevitable. He also presciently predicted that with the Vietnamization of the conflict, there may never be an accounting for these crimes. With the New York editors still dragging their feet and the article in limbo, Buckley handed over the reins of the Saigon Bureau and took a long vacation. When he returned to New York in the spring of 1972, he again pushed for the article's publication, finally asking for the right to freelance it elsewhere. Newsweek's editors refused, fearing they might be seen as faint-hearted for not publishing the exposé themselves. At last, I got a reason out of the editor, Kermit Lansner, Buckley told an interviewer some years later. He told me that it would be a gratuitous attack on the Nixon administration at this point to do another story on civilian deaths after the press had given the Army in Washington such a hard time over My Lai. Buckley and Chimkin's piece, whittled down to 1,800 words, finally appeared in the June 19, 1972 issue of Newsweek, which hit the newsstands around June 12th. Billed as Buckley's Vietnam farewell piece, it was bylined only to him and was irreparably compromised by editing that excised much of Buckley and Chimkin's reporting. Many key facts, eyewitness interviews, and even any mention of Julian Ewell's name were all left on the cutting room floor. In its eviscerated state, the article attracted only a slight ripple of interest. The story of Speedy Express, which should have been even more explosive than Seymour Hersh's expose on My Lai, quickly faded away. Had Buckley and Chimkin's investigation been published in full form in January or February 1972, it might have proven to be the crest of the wave of interest in war crimes allegations, resulting in irresistible public pressure for high-level inquiries. Had the Army been called to account, had Westmoreland's cover-up unraveled under the glare of hearings, had the suppressed allegations of the concerned sergeant been brought to light and linked to reports from the whistleblowing advisors in the Mekong Delta, as well as to the testimony of veterans at the Winter Soldier investigation, and had other veterans been emboldened to step forward, Speedy Express might have transformed the country's understanding of the entire conflict. With the military already buckling under the weight of internal dissent, it might have blown the lid off the entire American project in Vietnam and called the American way of war into serious question. Of course, none of those might-have-beens ever happened. On June 15, 1972, A Newsweek reporter in Washington asked if either the Pentagon or MACV were conducting any investigation of the reports that the 9th Infantry Division killed about 5,000 civilians in Operation Speedy Express in the Mekong Delta. The Defense Department simply answered no, a response as unambiguous as it was untrue. An internal Newsweek cable from Nick Prophet, Buckley's successor as Saigon bureau chief, noted that a high MACV source says Army launched a probe into Newsweek's Speedy Express story with purpose of compiling a rebuttal. So far, investigation has come to the conclusion that story was right on target, and indeed most of those killed during operation were civilians. In fact, on the day the Newsweek article appeared in the United States, a cable had shot from the Pentagon to Saigon about the piece, and by the morning of June 14th, the chief of the MACV Inspector General's Investigative Division was already working on an analysis of the article and of Speedy Express. A week and a half later, he presented his findings, including a startling admission. While there appears to be no means of determining the precise number of civilian casualties incurred by U.S. forces during Operation Speedy Express, it would appear that the extent of these casualties was in fact substantial, and that a fairly solid case can be constructed to show that civilian casualties may have amounted to several thousand, between 5,000 and 7,000. The Inspector General's report called Buckley's article irresponsible and attempted at every turn to minimize American culpability. Nevertheless, its conclusions were stunning. Not only did the report paint the Newsweek figure of 5,000 non-combatant deaths as a low-end estimate, which meant that non-combatants were likely the majority of those killed by U.S. forces during Speedy Express, but it also validated Buckley's contention that civilian deaths were a constant, accepted, and indeed inevitable result of Ewell's operation. Moreover, the secret report acknowledged that commanders had initiated the atrocities with eyes wide open. The U.S. command, in its extensive experience with large-scale combat operations in Southeast Asia, appreciated the inevitability of significant civilian casualties in the conduct of large operations in densely populated areas such as the Delta. The Inspector General's findings were the ultimate smoking gun, but they too were expertly suppressed. The information would be kept secret not only from Buckley and, as a result, the American people, but from lawmakers as well. In a letter to Buckley that fall, Senator J. William Fulbright, chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, lamented the difficulties encountered by the committee when it tried to get any answers from the military. "I would like to pursue the matter," Fulbright assured Buckley, but he seemed resigned to being stonewalled. "I'm very doubtful that anything can be done to fix responsibility for possible atrocities committed in connection with Operation Speedy Express." And when the Iowa senator and Army veteran Harold Hughes directly questioned Pentagon officials about Speedy Express, they had a ready answer. In a September 1972 letter, Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense Dennis Doolin explained to Hughes that MACV was unable to substantiate Buckley's estimate of civilian victims and had told him so while the article was being prepared. No information developed by any source since that time has been able to substantiate it as well, Doolin now wrote. "Nevertheless, you may rest assured that the Departments of Defense and the Army will continue to investigate specific allegations of war crimes as they are reported." John Paul Vann died in a non-combat-related helicopter crash in Vietnam days before Buckley and Shimkin's article was published in Newsweek. About a month later, Shimkin was killed while on assignment in Quang Tri Province. Buckley took a year's sabbatical and eventually left Newsweek. The concerned sergeant stayed silent, and his letters remained buried in the Army secret archives, as did the Army investigation that validated his allegations and Buckley and Shimkin's findings. With them all went the last best chance for the truth about the war to finally emerge. In 1973, Ewell and Hunt were commissioned by the Army to document their methods for use by future commanders. The book they produced, titled Sharpening the Combat Edge, whitewashed the history of their time in the Mekong Delta, failed to even mention Speedy Express by name, and completely ignored the allegations against them, save for a few dismissive lines. The 9th Infantry Division and 2 Field Force Vietnam have been criticized on the grounds that their obsession with body count was either basically wrong or else led to undesirable practices, Ewell and Hunt wrote. The basic inference that they were obsessed with body count is not true. Instead, they claimed, their methods had ended up unbrutalizing the war. A few decades later, Hunt would write a history of the 9th Infantry Division in Vietnam that, not surprisingly, also almost totally ignored allegations about the mass killing of civilians. To say that the military's top-level cover-ups and Newsweek's partial suppression of its own investigation were effective would be an understatement. There have been more than 30,000 nonfiction books published on the Vietnam War since the conflict began, but only a tiny fraction focus on American atrocities. Of these, nearly all the ones written since 1975 concentrate exclusively on the My Lai massacre or narrowly investigate a particular subject. And while some of the texts on atrocities written during the war cast a wider net, they were necessarily anecdotal, fragmentary, and speculative, lacking official documentary evidence and a comprehensive picture of the war's entire duration across the various regions of the country. Only by combining veterans' testimonies, contemporaneous press coverage, Vietnamese eyewitness accounts, long-classified official studies, and the military's own formal investigations into the many hundreds of atrocity cases that it knew about can one begin to grasp what the Vietnam War really entailed. After the war, most scholars wrote off the accounts of widespread war crimes that recur throughout Vietnamese revolutionary publications and American anti-war literature as merely so much propaganda. Few academic historians even thought to cite such sources, and almost none did so extensively. Meanwhile, My Lai came to stand for, and thus blot out, all other American atrocities. Vietnam War bookshelves are now filled with big-picture histories, sober studies of diplomacy and military tactics, and combat memoirs told from the soldier's perspective. Buried in forgotten U.S. government archives, locked away in the memories of atrocity survivors, the real American War in Vietnam has all but vanished from public consciousness.